The year ahead in Maine politics. From the State House to the White House, 2018 promises to be another year of expected and unexpected political news. In Augusta, lawmakers have just begun a session that will test their ability to solve several major policy issues, including funding Medicaid expansion and how to regulate the retail sale of recreational marijuana. Both laws were passed by voters, but have been stalled because of State House politics. And the drama is likely to grow, especially in light of the governor's race and congressional elections. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program, we'll talk with our regular team of analysts from across the aisle, Maine Public Radio's weekly political roundtable, about what's in store for Maine politics and how what's playing out on the national scene could affect us here. And as always, we want to hear from you. Maine Calling is next. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. There's the race to replace Governor Paul LePage. There's the second congressional district race, which is being watched nationally. And there are a host of issues before the legislature, from paying for Medicaid expansion to regulating retail marijuana sales, that will likely interest even the most casual political observers. Today, I have three former politicians and regular guests on Maine Public's Across the Aisle segment with me to share their take on what issues they think will dominate in Maine and beyond this year. Joining me in the studio, Meredith Strang Burgess is a Republican who served at the State House and is president and CEO of Burgess Advertising and Marketing. Cynthia Dill is a Democrat who also served in the legislature and is an attorney. And Dick Woodbury is an independent, an economist, and also a former lawmaker. As always, we want to hear from you. Which issues do you think will dominate the legislature this session? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. We're going to start off, though, with our friend and colleague, Steve Missler. He's the chief political correspondent and State House bureau chief for Maine Public, who joins us right now. Steve, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what do you see, Steve, as the two or I guess three issues that you think may dominate the discussion in Augusta this session?
Well, I think first we should probably point out that that these issues will dominate the discussion, but it doesn't necessarily mean that anything will actually get done. And you hit on two of them at the top of the program, which is Medicaid expansion, which voters approved by nearly a 60% margin at the polls in November. And now the legislature has to try to find a way out to fund that program, to fund the state's share. That will be a huge issue, and that will be colored by the political ambitions of three people that are running for governor. Three of them are all in Republican leadership. And so I think that's going to be a big one. Also, you mentioned creating a regulatory structure for recreational marijuana, which the legislature tried and failed to do last year. That effort was blocked by Governor Paul LePage. And I think we heard some news yesterday that'll make passing that framework even more difficult going forward, because Attorney General Jeff Sessions has basically reversed a Obama policy that basically allowed for states to go ahead legalizing marijuana. It'll put it up to the U.S. Attorneys General to potentially prosecute, or basically it'll make it harder, and it'll probably give cover to those who don't want recreational marijuana to ever happen in Maine, to just sort of let the law the way it is right now stand. And so there will be a lot of talk and headlines about those issues, and but there may not be anything that actually gets done.
Sure. And you mentioned some of the candidates for governor are actually in leadership positions in Augusta. How many candidates do we have now in this race for governor as of 1:09:36 on this Friday?
Yeah,
and,
right.
are there any front runners?
Yeah, so I mean, I risk actually pointing out a number because somebody might take out papers as we speak, but it's over 20 at the moment. It's closer to two dozen, And again, several of those are in the legislature. You asked if there are front runners. It's really difficult to say because a lot of these candidates are known only to the people that are in the Augusta circles. You know, I mean, outside of Augusta in the state house, they may not be well known at all to most Mainers. So what we have to go on is name recognition. And if that's the metric, then somebody like Janet Mills on the Democratic side, who's the attorney general, she probably has some name recognition, maybe more than most of the other Democratic candidates, former House Speaker Mark Eaves. And, of course, Adam Cody, who ran for Congress in 2007, I'm not sure that many Mainers will remember that, but he did have a strong showing in a very crowded primary field, and he's sort of running as an outsider candidate. And on the Republican side, speaking of outsiders, you have Sean Moody, who had an unsuccessful gubernatorial run in 2010. But he seemed to garner this appeal as an outsider, although this time his campaign is being run by insiders that are almost all connected to the current LePage administration. But him and former DHHS Commissioner Mary Mayhew, Senate President Mike Thibodeau, Majority Leader Garrett Mason, and Minority Leader in the House Ken Fredette are all in the Republican field. And I think that all of them are probably in the same in terms of name recognition. And it's going to be up to them to sort of elevate their profile to be more familiar to more Maine voters.
So what else will you be paying attention to in this session?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that, you know, the one thing we really need to keep an eye on all the time, and this was in the news this week, is changes to the citizen initiative process. Over the last 2 years, we've seen a lot of an explosion, really, in citizen initiatives and ballot initiatives. And those initiatives, once they are passed, the legislature has to deal with them. And we've already seen that the legislature has some problems with that, whether it's they've tinkered or changed or delayed or outright repealed voter-approved laws. There's currently a people's veto underway to reverse the legislature's decision in the fall to try to repeal ranked choice voting. That will suspend the law that the legislature passed, but it could be on the ballot in June, when at the same time that Mainers are using that very same system to select their gubernatorial candidates, in their primary races. And we saw this week that there's already a movement afoot to make qualifying for the ballot a lot harder. I don't know if that proposal will get very far, given that there was such an outpouring of opposition to it. But I don't think that's the last we're going to see of legislative efforts to restrict or cut down on a number of ballot initiatives that appear before voters.
All right, Steve, we'll have to see. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
Steve Missler, the chief political correspondent and State House bureau chief for Maine Public. Well, Dick, Meredith, Cynthia, happy new year, first of all.
Yes, happy new year.
Happy new year.
Happy new year to you.
Steve kind of laid out some of the things that we'll talk about today. But let me ask you, I'll start with you, Cynthia. Steve sort of suggesting there'll be a lot of sound and fury signifying maybe not nothing, but not a whole lot in this session.
Well, I think especially on the Republican side, as Steve Missler mentioned, three members of Republican leadership are all vying for the Republican nomination for governor. And given that they have to work together if they're going to accomplish anything, but at the same time set themselves apart from one another if they're going to, try to win the primary, I think it's going to be high drama in Republican politics. On the Democratic side, I would say at the legislature, there's no real conflict pitting one Democratic leader against another. In the Senate, we have Troy Jackson, Aaron Herbig, who is the House current majority leader, is running for state Senate. Jared Golden, the assistant leader, is running for the 2nd Congressional District, and the Speaker of the House is running for a second term. So they're all sort of rowing in the same direction, and they have the Medicaid expansion referendum at their backs, kind of pushing things forward and possibly driving a wedge between Republicans, but hopefully getting enough of them on board to fully fund this expansion effort, which will bring along, I think, a lot of Democrats in the 2018 election.
Well, let's go to the, if you want to stay on the expansion effort, do you see it that way, Meredith?
Oh, well, if you want to get into the Medicaid and Medicare.
You can respond generally to
exactly,
her comments.
But, you know, I was just sort of dealing on the sort of the top of the issues here. You know, Steve laid it out extremely well. And I do agree with Cynthia's take on sort of the Republicans. You're right. There's going to need to be a little elbowing, I think, aside going on to session to sort of reach some points of distinction within themselves. But overarching for the legislative session, I think that there will be some substance. To a certain extent, there has to be some substance that comes out of it. Almost each of those issues that Steve rattled off there, you know, including the whole marijuana piece of legislation, which right now is set to go into place in some fashion on February 1st, unless it's postponed. So there needs to be some form of action. I think they were working on that this morning.
And we'll get to each of the issues. I didn't want to rush you into fascinating Medicaid expansion. But, Dick, just your general thoughts then, I guess, about the prospects for some progress in this session.
Well, we have to remember we have a governor who enjoys very much using the veto pen. And so given that he, it's very hard to override his vetoes. So having him on board with something is a very hard thing to get to in the current legislative session. And, of course, the Democrats have a majority in the House. So finding a place where there's an agreement between the Democratic majority that's in the House and a governor who likes to veto things is not always an easy thing. So I think that makes it difficult. I also think it's always compounded in an election year when the majority of people who are sitting in the legislature are also candidates for re-election in the legislature and want to get back to the streets and going door to door and doing the campaign work. So they, you know, they don't want to be in Augusta that long, and that makes it harder to get things done in this short session as well.
So with respect to Medicaid, this is about the funding. Since the expansion itself was approved by voters, the next step, is to pay for it. And the governor has said, well, you know, anything that you put by me to pay for it, Cynthia, I am going to not agree with. I'm going to veto, essentially. So promising to not go along with any of the funding. Are Democrats going to be able to, as they've said, vowed to get around that and somehow find a way to make this happen?
Well, I think, as Dick pointed out, that the politics, just the infrastructure of the political vote is the same in that every single proposal has to be able to override a veto in order to move forward. So the numbers are the same. They need, you know, the numbers to override a veto. In terms of Medicaid expansion, the governor has threatened to throw a wrench in the works of funding, but that's like every other budget that the governor has proposed that the legislature has rejected and then has had to amass the requisite number of votes to override the veto. So the funding question is sort of the same if they can get to the majority. But the governor can do other things to obstruct, like, for instance, under the law, the Department of Health and Human Services, an executive department under the governor, is obligated to submit an amended plan to the feds by a certain date. And, you know, presumably they would do that. That's the law. However, we know with this governor and this administration, they challenge things and could possibly not follow the law and take a stand. And we could be embroiled in litigation over whether or not even a plan is submitted. So there's a lot of ways that the governor can obstruct. I do think, though, that the Democrats, no matter what, are going to come out ahead because 60% of Maine people came out in an election and said they wanted to expand Medicaid. So we, the people, are, you know, we want Medicaid expansion. And that's a tough thing to just not do in an election year.
Yeah, Meredith, this is a little bit of a test here. On one hand, you've got we, the people, as Cynthia said, and we'll talk a little bit later about how the legislature has undone a number of citizen initiatives. But heading into an election year, so you've got on the one hand, we, the people, on the other hand, this Republican issue of welfare, which has had a lot of traction for the Republicans. Might they paint Medicaid expansion as a welfare expansion and win on that side? And isn't this a test, really, of those two, I guess, political leverage points?
Yes. if only the issue was that simple. So the Medicaid issue, which is sort of one of my pet issues out there exactly has so many different parts and pieces that are pushing on things here. So we've got the referenda process. So the people pass a referenda. Well, people have to understand that the referendas that are passed still come back into the legislature to be implemented or to fix the rules or write the rules to put them into place, which sort of gets back to the other issue, which, as you mentioned, we'll get into a little later, which is this whole referenda process, so that Medicaid expansion isn't quite as simple as that. Well, I guess there in the ACA, there was Medicaid expansion, and it was a process written for you to do Medicaid expansion in its purest sort of idealistic way. But in fact, there's a number of states that have done a modified expansion. And even our own Senator Collins has been an advocate for Maine to consider a different version and actually apply for some waivers, which gets, as Cynthia said, the DHHS has to apply to CMS in Washington for whatever kind of approvals and different things. And the state of Indiana has one that I think is very, very attractive. And it's unfortunate that the Republicans in the last couple of years haven't sort of been willing to take that off the shelf and really give it a really good look-see. But what happens is you have an outside organization come in, they write a bill sort of in a vacuum, and then they take it out to the people and they say, oh, it's very simple. It's just Medicaid expansion. Well, it's not. And the bill has issues and flaws in it that need to be fixed regardless whether you were for it or against it. It's, if you're for it, there are fixes that need to happen. So people need to kind of understand that just because the people said by 60% or 58.5% that they said, yes, this is a great idea, that it is maybe an idea, let's take it in and let's study it.
Dick, you have a personal stake in this because of one of your favorite initiatives, ranked choice voting, underwent the same fate. It was passed by the voters. It was undone by the legislature. And now there's this people's veto initiative to undo their undoing of it. And back and forth it goes. But is there no, I guess, is this a political calculation on the part of these legislators saying, well, people will forgive us for undoing these initiatives because there are bigger issues at stake or bigger themes that are more important politically?
Well, the first thing to say that's a little different than the way that Meredith described it is when a referendum passes, it becomes the law in the same way as if the legislature passes the law. So it's actually a proactive decision by the legislature to then change the law again. And, you know, that's where I think the circumstance of this year, where it's not that every time an initiative passes, the legislature needs to do something. The fact that they did that with every single referendum this time really has felt, I think, to many in the public like they were overstepping their authority when the people are the ultimate democracy. And so I think that's how a lot of us who are involved with the ranked choice voting campaign felt. And I think a lot of the energy around the people's veto right now is in part a frustration with the legislature overstepping its bounds.
I would just like to point out also that given that this citizens' initiative was on the heels of five bills that passed the legislature to expand Medicaid that went through the veto process, that there have been plenty of opportunities for public hearings, for comment, for study. I mean, the people know what it is that they want, and they have voted for it. So the I think the Maine legislature would be remiss in not honoring the will of the people in this regard because it has been such a thoroughly studied issue and is something that is being implemented across the country.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. I promise we can get back to this. The number to join the conversation is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do University of New England, where students study abroad at five times the national average. Discover more at une.edu. And Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Lots of cities love their football teams, sometimes irrationally. When the Colts were in Baltimore, the connection seemed solid.
Johnny Unitas ran an acetylene torch at the Bethlehem Steel Plant. They had to work, and then they would go to their other job, which happened to be football.
The enduring charm of the Baltimore Colts, coming up this week on Only a Game. Join us.
Join us for Only a Game tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. You can stream many of your favorite Maine Public Television programs, both PBS and local, online through our on-demand service at mainepublic.org. There's plenty of opportunity for binge-watching. Evergreen supporters can also access Passport, which allows you to watch many of the program archives. Think of it as a Netflix service for public television. You could watch entire seasons or even entire series. Talk about a New Year's resolution. Passport is already available to Evergreen contributors of both Maine Public Television and Maine Public Radio. More information at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, a look ahead at the Maine political landscape in 2018. With me in studio are Across the Aisle team, Cynthia Dill, an attorney who served in the legislature as a Democrat, Dick Woodbury, an economist and former independent lawmaker, and Meredith Strang Burgess is with Burgess Advertising and Marketing and is a Republican who served in the State House. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, we were talking about this issue of the legislature undoing citizens' initiatives to a degree much stronger, much more, to a higher degree than ever in the past, it seems. Meredith, you had a comment.
I did. I just wanted to pop in sort of to follow up on Cynthia's comment that the Republicans or that there was the legislature had five whacks at the apple really to sort of get their hands around it, but it was it never went anywhere, including, you know, vetoes. Therefore, the people knew what they wanted and went to the ballot box and voted. If it was only sort of that simple. So what happened after what the piece that the citizens of Maine voted on, there was a piece of legislation that was written, again, in a complete vacuum from one perspective, and that's what went out to the people. And the issue is so much more complex than that, and it's part of a bigger issue. And one of the reasons you're seeing the legislature have to make some modifications with the number of the recent referendums that have passed is that the referendums have become so much more complicated, and there are pieces of legislation that are written behind them. And I would challenge that most Maine voters have read the paragraph that is sort of either synthesized for us on the ballot and have probably not sat down and read the whole piece of legislation. And I think we'd be really surprised if they did, or if they even realized that that's there. So that's the piece. And I think it's a process. It's an education. And I do want to correct myself. Dick is absolutely correct that once the people pass that a referenda, it is law, but it does come into the legislature because lately they have all needed to be tweaked in some fashion.
Well, let's get to another one, which is the rules for retail recreational marijuana sales. This was an initiative passed by the citizenry. A special panel, Cynthia, was set up to write the rules to make this thing happen, and it just went nowhere. The governor is not a fan of recreational marijuana. Others in the legislature aren't. Now it's been kicked into this session and faces a very short time before the moratorium that had been placed on retail sales expires. What are the chances of some kind of deal here that could move Maine forward on this initiative?
Well, I spoke with some members of the committee this morning who are optimistic that they have been able to, you know, iron out the differences that some of the different groups had. However, as we all know, the Attorney General for the United States issued a memorandum that rescinded an earlier Obama administration memorandum that told federal prosecutors to basically lay off prosecuting marijuana crimes in states where, you know, they've legalized it. So this, I think, adds some cover to those who are opposed to the implementation of the law. This referendum question just passed by a sliver, so there's not as much of a mandate as there was with the Medicaid expansion. And just the fact that there exists a federal law making possession, use, sale of marijuana, you know, designating it a class one type of drug and making it a crime, it's a different animal. I do think that there'll be progress. I think that so much will depend on whether or not Governor LePage can get on board, because if he signals his opposition, that is going to trigger a defiance in the House by that faction led by Ken Fredette, and there'll be the dynamics that we're very familiar of, you know, the House perhaps preventing the veto from being overridden. So I think marijuana advocates are rightfully cautious at this point because of the uncertainty at the federal level. The big question is what our Attorney General Halsey Frank, a Trump appointee, but also like basically like good government Department of Justice lawyer for many years, does. He has indicated in an opinion in 2013 that he thinks, you know, we sort of have enough of intoxicated people wandering around, and we have to draw the line between substances that are legal and illegal somewhere. And while marijuana may seem random, if it's going to be legalized, it should be done in a democratic way. He seems, in my view, to suggest that that he's not going to be a hard line prosecutor of de minimis marijuana crimes. That would be my prediction. But of course, we have to await what he actually says.
All right, we're going to go to the phones now. We'll bring in Susan from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about the citizen initiative process. I'm a volunteer working on the Ranked Choice Voting Initiative. I've been collecting signatures, and I've been amazed at how strong the support is for ranked choice voting. It's very positive. People understand it. They understand the problems it's correcting. It actually won a national award for a state governmental reform, and the legislature, the governor, and the secretary of state have been putting incredible barriers in place against it. The latest one, this move to prohibit us collecting signatures at the polls. And I have seen lots of safeguards in place to protect the integrity of the whole process and huge amounts of volunteer time that have to go into successful completion of these initiatives. And I just want to express the level of anger and frustration that I feel and that I see among the people I talk to about this at these barriers that are putting in place against the will of the people.
Okay, Kathy, thank you. Just a couple of notes on this. One is we should mention that there were some legal issues with ranked choice voting. It ran afoul of the state constitution over the wording of plural versus et cetera. We know that. So that does have to be worked out, and I guess in the form of a constitutional amendment or some sort of resolution. But the other interesting thing to me was that this proposal to have the 50-foot barrier for petition signatures came from Matt Dunlap, who is also in the same week recognized as a national champion for smiting down this dragon that was for progressives. The president's voter fraud commission. He threatened to sue, and then the president pulled the plug on the commission. But it just seemed like an unlikely proposal from Matt Dunlap.
Well, see, and that's because people assume that Matt Dunlap, as a Democrat, has a political motivation behind every step that he takes, where I think Matt Dunlap likes being at the table and in the game and being a player. And so if there is going to be a bill that has to do with voting, he wants to be a part of it. So I think he can simultaneously, you know, be the, like you said, the person who slays the dragon that was the presidential commission, and at the same time try to bring to the public discourse this issue of whether or not overly aggressive signature gatherers are somehow chilling people's willingness or ability to vote. I agree with Susan, the caller. I think there is nothing to suggest that volunteer signature gatherers in polling places in Maine have done anything to hinder or intimidate any voters. And I think this bill is going to be met with fierce opposition, not only from voters, but from people who participate in elections. I mean, if all the petition gatherers have to be 50 feet away from the polling place, what that essentially does is take the referendum question process, the citizens' initiative process that's embedded in the Constitution as our rights, and making it impossible for volunteers to be successful. The only way you're going to be successful is if you're Sean Scott and can pay signature gatherers to go out on the streets and spend hours and collect signatures. If you're going to rely on volunteers,
Sean Scott is a casino developer.
The casino guy who wanted to, you know, us to vote for to give him millions of dollars. But if you expect volunteers to be successful at gathering the requisite number of signatures, you have to give them a warm place and, you know, some time reasonable to collect signatures. So I understand and relate to Susan's frustration and anger, and I hope that that there's no tinkering with the signature gathering process.
Meredith?
But I think it's really important that I agree with a lot of what Cynthia says. I was a little surprised, frankly, not to see the legislation come in, but to actually see that our Secretary of State was the author of it. But you've got to also remember the constituency that he has to represent, which are the clerks of all of our towns and cities across the state of Maine who are doing their best to conduct quality, ethical, safe, non-interfered elections on all of our behalf across the state of Maine. And there has been a lot of citizens who have voiced opinions to their town clerks over the course of time about the quantity of sort of interaction, or that there's sort of this gauntlet of folks that are at the elections at our different municipalities the day of the elections, that some people are overwhelmed, feel pressured, et cetera, et cetera. Now, obviously, one is to say, you know, people need to, we talk about how it's so important for people to be as informed as possible and when they go to vote. But some people don't have time or whatever to know every different detail, and they get asked to sign different things. And there sort of has been a little bit of some feeling that people sort of like, well, gee, I have to sign it. All my friends are sort of looking to do that. So anyway, that will all come out in the process that will go through the legislature. There'll be public hearings and all. And I would be surprised if it really goes a whole lot further.
I share Susan's frustration, but I want to put a little bit of a positive spin on where this is too, with the people's veto that's happening right now. People are going to get to use ranked choice voting in this upcoming primary, and there's 12 Democratic candidates for governor right now. There's 5 Republican candidates for governor right now. They're going to use it in action and then vote on whether they liked it and want to keep that system, and I'm of a mind, kind of imagining myself voting in one of these primaries, that I'm going to like ranking the candidates and having more voice in the process so much that this is going to pass by a far wider margin than it did the first time.
Because the question is on the June.
It's on the same June ballot, right? When people will be using it for the first time in the primaries.
Well, I guess I have a question for Dick. But has the Republican Party said that it's going to use ranked choice voting in the Republican primary? I mean, I thought the parties were in control of some. So is that
it's a statutory. It's still, even the party primaries are in statutes.
All right. Well.
Well, it depends on which order the question's in. Like if you if you vote on ranked choice voting before you do the ranked choice voting, you may not know how you feel about it. I've confused myself. Let's go to Kathy in Holden. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, I'm calling because I think that voters have voted to try to pass a law, and there's always information about how people don't vote, and so I think if we vote and we can't pass a law, it'll discourage people from voting even more.
I'll let you respond to that here before we go to break. Kathy's saying this will have a chilling effect on a issue that's already of concern. Even though we do have relatively good turnout, Maine does pretty well, but by some standards, we could do better.
Well, nobody wants to waste their time. If you're going to go out and cast a vote and it doesn't mean anything, then there's no incentive to really get up out of bed and go vote. So I agree with Kathy.
Me too.
Yeah.
And me three? Or?
Well, I think that people need to be as informed as possible.
Okay.
And vote.
All right. I do want to get to, we want to get to the races, which are very important. We're going to do that. Join the conversation here. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Coming up after the break, we'll talk about the race for governor, the second district, which is being watched nationally, and a number of other big ticket items here on Maine's political landscape in 2018. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Highland Green of Topsom, proudly supporting Saturday Afternoon Opera, which airs tomorrow beginning at 1 p.m. on Maine Public Classical. Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org.
In Tune Friday night, it's a new year with new music. This Friday, new music from Neil Young, Darlingside, Ages and Ages, and so much more. I'm Sarah Willis. Join me Friday night at 8 here on Maine Public Radio.
Talk to the people. They know the truth. Time don't mean nothing. It's the ways that you choose to go on living.
When locals in Groveton, New Hampshire drive by the old paper mill in town, they remember a time when it and the town were thriving.
And they say, isn't it sad? It's crying time. I said, that's right.
On Next, from the New England News Collaborative, what happens when a company leaves a company town? I hope you can join us.
Next is coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling, right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, gazing into our political crystal ball to see what issues may dominate in Augusta and beyond in the year ahead. In the studio with me, Dick Woodbury. He's an economist and former independent lawmaker. Cynthia Dill, an attorney who served in the legislature as a Democrat. And Meredith Strang Burgess with Burgess Advertising and Marketing, who served at the State House as a Republican. Join the conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We have to get to the races, of course. Let's start with the governor's race, which, as we've said, has a growing field of candidates in it. Depending upon what number you believe, there might be fewer candidates in there, may there not be, by the time we get to the March deadline for gathering signatures and for getting these seed contributions to qualify for public funding for clean elections money. Do you expect, Cynthia, the field will be the same size by then?
I don't expect the field to be the exact same size for the reasons that you just mentioned. It's actually quite difficult to gather the requisite number of, you know, authentic or, you know, certifiable signatures. And for people seeking clean election money, it's really hard to get the number of $5 checks in the bank and in the right forms. There's just a lot of I's to dot and T's to cross, and some candidates will be wiped off the list because they haven't been able to, you know, overcome those hurdles. Other candidates will just slowly sort of fade off into the wind because they won't be able to post the fundraising numbers. They won't be able to make press releases and otherwise get in the public eye. So the conversation will never focus on them, and they'll just kind of disappear, and they probably won't show up at or be invited to all of the debates. So it'll come down to, I would say, a stage of probably five or six, you know, legitimate candidates who will be vying for a very small group of people to show up at the primary and vote.
What will be the themes, do you think, in the Republican primary, Meredith?
The themes? Well, you know, that's because, as we've talked about earlier, we've got so many of them, basically all of them with, so Mary Mayhew is certainly not currently at DHHS. But we have three candidates who are currently serving in the legislature, and you've got Mary Mayhew just sort of recently having left DHHS, and then Sean Moody on the outside aspect of it. So Sean's kind of left to be able to sort of form his theme, if you will, and he gets to sort of take his track. He hasn't ever served in an elected, state elected office, so he doesn't have a record and all that, which makes it sort of interesting. But the others, You know, Mary's certainly going to have to run with her theme around some form of healthcare, welfare, I would suppose would be her piece that she can claim to have had a major role in. And the others are going to be working hard to kind of craft that over the next 4 months.
Do you think Moody will be the outsider? Will that be his angle?
Well, that's what he certainly ran on before. However, as again was noted, his team is quite very much entirely the inside team. It's currently sort of everyone who's been involved with Governor LePage's elections, which was a real sort of eyebrow raiser for a lot of folks because it really sort of flies in the face of his being able to be fresh and outside the system and looking in.
Dick, on the independent side, there's no unenrolled primary, obviously.
Nope.
There's a green primary, though, it looks like they're shaping up to be. But just in general, in the general election, what do independent candidates, what are their themes going to be? Are they going to be their own individual themes, or is there a winning strategy?
I think there'll be individual themes. At the moment, there are five independent candidates who've registered with the Ethics Commission. Three of them are people who have, I'd say, at least the average of the name recognition of the rest of the candidates that are from the parties. One is State Treasurer Terry Hayes, who is the first independent to be a treasurer. Another is Alan Caron, who has written a number of books that have provided a vision for what Maine's economic future should look like that have been very well received, in fact, by both party sides. John Jenkins, of course, has been mayor of Lewiston and Auburn. So these are candidates that I think have real credibility, and the other independents may too, but I'm not aware of them yet.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that in terms of themes, there are more themes to the Democratic primary other than just reducing the number of people on the list. but I would say for Democrats, the challenge is going to be in the primary, overcoming whatever differences there are between the Clinton-Bernie camps. But generally, I think Democrats have learned, especially from the last gubernatorial race, that they can't run on a platform that only speaks of government benefits. And so even though Medicaid expansion is a theme that Democrats have a solid win on, they have to create a platform, I believe, in order to attract moderates, independents towards economic and, you know, the economy and jobs. And so I think that the Democrats that can walk that walk, that can manage to navigate a primary and then get to the general election with a jobs message, especially with the Trump tax cuts and sort of the failure in Washington under Republican administration and under Republican Congress to really move. We're in a vibrant economy. The stock market's booming, but we have kind of a crazy president and people are scared. And so Democrats have to send a real strong economic security message going into the general election.
All right. Let's go to Edward in Kittery. Hi, Edward. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I was just wondering, I have a couple of questions, a couple of statements. I hate to divert it back to the topic that we were just on, but, you know, Maine voters are going to have to look long and hard at what they want and what they're going to get. I think with the elections in last November, in 2016, we didn't get a lot of the stuff that we voted for, and now we're in a pickle. Marijuana, let's bring that up again. The federal government has just put out statements saying they're going to go after it. If we made a law about this, we would be that far ahead of it. And now we're in a pickle. And now Maine voters are upset over that. Maine voters are upset over numerous things. And I think, LePage, he's done a lot to put what he wants in. And, he's been very verbal about what he wants and what his lawmakers want versus what the state's people need.
All right, Edward. Thank you. Sorry to cut you off. We're running short on time, so I want to bring in a few more people. Any comments on?
Well, I just want to say, you know, in terms of the marijuana question, the bottom line is Congress has to decide. The states, the Congress has to come out and decide whether they want to legalize marijuana or not.
I agree.
All right, let's go to Kurt in Poland. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, a great show. Getting back to citizen referendums, the issue is they're really not vetted legally or constitutionally before they're presented, and that's an issue. If you talk to most of the judges privately, they'll tell you, you know, they're a train wreck waiting to hit. So the problem is that becomes a real barrier to that initiative if you have to test it constitutionally before it goes in front of the voters. But in general, it's a poor way to legislate. It's the inability of our legislators to really find the needs of their voters and present those issues. So, and track most of the states, probably 3/4 of all the referendums wind up in the courts because they're so poorly written. And we were warned prior to this, like on the marijuana one, that there were some issues. No one seems to want to pay attention to them. And this final note, the voters aren't critical thinkers sometimes. It's a very emotional, you know, they read a paragraph and then it's an emotional response to this. But
all right, Kurt, thank you very much. He has a point that there are questions that get out there and we raise questions about them beforehand. At least the opposition will say, well, we think that's unconstitutional. And then we do run into these problems. So is there a way to get out ahead of that, maybe?
Well, I mean, Exhibit A for, you know, the occasional failure of the electoral process is President Trump. You know, it just doesn't always work out the way we would expect it would in a democracy. Sometimes the numbers do add up to a really bad sum, whether it be a candidate that proves to be incompetent or an inept or a question that's too complicated. But I would say, all in all, the process is one of citizen engagement. It's embedded in the Constitution that we have a right to petition our government. And it seems to me like we have to take the good with the bad. And if there's a bad question, deal with it.
But what Kurt was saying, though, is he was talking about the referendum process and what we were talking about earlier in the fact that there's legislation that gets written in a vacuum and then put out in a very simplified way as a question, and that there's so much more to the issue.
I do want to get to the second district race. This is a big race being watched nationally, and we have incumbent Bruce Poliquin, the Republican, defending his seat, and I think a group of six Democrats at this point in the primary vying for that. What's going to be give me the profile, I guess, Meredith, of how you think this race plays out.
Well, so Bruce Poliquin, so he's completed two successful elections. So, you know, he has definitely the power of incumbency that's very, very strong that's out there. It's an every 2-year process. There's been a lot of noise this past time. You know, was he avoiding talking to his constituency? People tried to stir that up. And yet he's one of the few congressmen from Maine who has gone down there and actually, you know, made some noise and been heard from and passed some legislation. Wrote legislation and actually got some passed, and he's a co-sponsor with a number of other pieces of legislation. So it's nice to see our congressman actually doing something down there and working across the aisle to a certain extent, which I think is going to play well for him as we go into 2018 here and as things heat up.
Way to work in across the aisle. Cynthia, in the last few moments here, what's your how do you see it?
I agree with Meredith. I do think that Bruce Poliquin has taken a few steps towards the center and has been emboldened somewhat to speak out about his positions. And he does have the power of incumbency in addition to a war chest made up mostly of, you know, contributions from, you know, Wall Street types because he sits on the Finance Committee. But Democrats have very strong candidates. I would say the two frontrunners are definitely Jared Golden and Lucas St. Clair. Both are well-funded, smart, bright, rising stars. And with Lucas St. Clair, he can point to a national monument, a jobs creator. And he's been prominent on the national stage and successful on an issue that is opposed to Bruce Poliquin. I mean, clearly they can differentiate themselves on that issue. And I think Lucas is on top. And Jared Golden is just an accomplished young man who served with Senator Collins, a veteran. He's smart as a tack. So Bruce Poliquin's got work to do, but I do think he has an edge.
May I raise a topic we haven't covered today?
Sure.
One of the things that happened between the end of the regular session last year and the session that's upcoming is a number of legislators in the Maine legislature withdrew from their party and became independents. And that group now is a group of seven who have office space and have a staff. There's a statewide organization called Maine Independents that was that's been formed that is actually recruiting and training candidates to run as independents. So I think we're going to see, in fact, in the upcoming legislature, a really interesting change in the dynamic where this swing group is going to be much more influential in the legislative process than they have been in the past.
All right. And with that, unfortunately, we're out of time.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, it was good. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it. And we'll see you next Thursday, right?
All right. Okay. What's today?
Cynthia Dill is an attorney, and Meredith Strang Burgess is with Burgess Advertising and Marketing. Dick Woodbury, an economist. Thanks again. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Owen Manahan took your calls. And you can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.org.